Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking to Stefan Schmidt, a CTO coach and author of Amazing CTO. Stefan shares his People First Playbook, a transformative approach to tech leadership that prioritizes trust, motivation, and alignment. We discuss the critical importance of hiring the right people, running effective one-to-ones, and why surprises are the enemy of good leadership. Stefan's insights are packed with actionable advice and stories from his extensive career, including a unique perspective on the pet versus cattle philosophy. I'm your host, Adam Horner. I'm also a coach, particularly helping new CTOs when navigating their first leadership roles. I empower tech leaders to break free from the daily grind of crisis management and build the skills to lead with confidence and purpose. Many CTOs I work with are former engineers who are promoted into leadership and then overwhelmed with constant firefighting, unsure how to communicate effectively with non-technical executives and uncertain about their strategic impact. Drawing on over 30 years of hands-on experience, I provide practical, personalized coaching tailored to these exact challenges, helping CTOs shift from reactive problem solving to proactive strategic leadership. My coaching helps each CTO forge their own path for growth, allowing them to delegate confidently, align engineering with business goals, and step into their roles as trusted, respected peers at the executive table. This podcast is my way of giving back to the communities of CTOs that have supported me over the years, and between me and my guests, we cover crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook to excel as a CTO. Stefan, thanks so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you because you've literally one of these people who've written the book on being a CTO. It's exciting to be able to have a chat with you today. But I'd love to have a little look at sort of your background. Where did you come from? How did you get into being a CTO? And then leading up to writing a book.
Very long story because you can see kind of my hair, old white man. So I've started by coding because as a kid, because I wanted to write video games. So I thought, playing video games, end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, I can do this too. I want to write my own video games. I have great ideas. So I teach myself programming in a department store. And then I became a programmer, and then I wrote some video games as a kid. And that's how I got into all of these tech things.
How did a department store come into it?
I didn't have a computer. Like, it was 1981. No one had a computer. Our friend had one, but there was not a lot of computers around. So, and the department store had computers. So we went there and had fun, and then we wrote some code.
Wow. Okay. Kind of like the old school library version of it then.
Yeah. Some little bit like that. And then many years later, during my computer science study at university, I wanted to have a job. I needed some money. I applied for a job. The job ad was, I think, 3 months old. I applied for the job. It was web programming. And I was the first person who applied for the job. And so I got it. I think the reason I got it was because I was the first one who applied after 3 months. So I became a professional coder. And then I needed to manage projects because I was the first person there. And then I needed to hire other people. And that's how I became an engineering manager.
Wow. So fairly early on, you were managing other people then in your career.
Yeah. In my career, that's funny thing is I didn't code a lot in my tech career. I managed more, like I coded for a short time and then became a manager because there was a need for one. And then often a hands-on manager in smaller organizations, but basically since then I've been a manager. And I became a head of development. In a way, I needed to go to a conference or to a computer science fair or something. And I needed to talk to Oracle, to IBM, because we want to buy a database. And I said, I need a business card for that. And then my boss gave me a business card, but there was no name and no title on it. And I said, I need a title. And then he said, yeah, well, think of one. And so I became head of development.
Invented your own title then.
I didn't know what CTO was back then. So no. Otherwise, I would be a CTO. But so I became head of development, and that's how I got into all of that.
Nice. And then so where was the journey between there and becoming a coach then?
Well, another 25 years or something. So this was in the mid-90s, and when the internet came to Germany, basically. And then I had my own startup. I was working in startups. I had my own startup. Too early, 1999, a web wiki and blog startup. No one knew what wiki and blog was. So we didn't, no success. A little bit success because the render engine that rendered wiki markup to HTML ended up in Atlassian Confluence for some time. So a little bit of success, didn't get anything, but little bit of personal success there.
Nice claim to fame, though.
Yeah. And larger, smaller companies, long story short, ended up working for eBay as the CTO of one of the eBay companies. eBay owns a lot of companies. And of one of the companies that eBay owns, I was the CTO. And then after some time, HR said, Stefan, or my boss said, Stefan, everything's fine. Department works. Everything's dandy. What do you want to do now? And so we agreed that I should become CEO. So I was on a high potential future leadership training, corporate enterprise training program. I was in the US. And after a year, I decided I don't want to become a CEO. I want to stay in tech. So I left eBay and stayed a little bit longer than I wanted because people asked me to stay longer. So I stayed a little bit longer. Then I joined the startup of my wife. I became the CTO there. After some years, she sold it. We hiked through Norway, deciding what to do. She's writing books, and I'm a CTO coach. So that's how I come up with being a CTO coach.
Nice. So it was basically post-exit transition then was to become a coach and start helping others.
Yes. Yes. The decision was, should I become a CTO again or not? And I thought, I'd seen so many things, and I don't want to see more things. So basically, I wanted to become a coach instead of joining the company as a CTO again.
Cool. So let's wind back to the beginning then and just talk about that early stage when you became a manager so early on then. So that must have shaped your approach to people and to how you lead engineers as a team lead then.
To be frank, I was a very bad engineering manager for a long time. I think made all the mistakes and no one helped me, and I didn't know what engineering management is. So, and I don't know what management is. So I think I was very bad. I think the thing that was good is that I'm kind of the person, if there is a group of people and they don't know what to do, I'm climbing on a table and say, let's do this or something. You know, that was when I was in kindergarten or something, or on the playground, I was climbing on things and say, let's do this. So I'm good at this. I don't know. But so this helped me tremendously. But I was, I think I made all the mistakes. And just that when I joined a large company in Germany, it's called Immobilien Scout. It's a real estate website. I came into contact with proper people management and management. So that was one step where I got a lot better at one-on-ones and supporting people and focusing on. I was always a people person, but not a professional one, you know.
Right. Okay. You're kind of figuring it out from first principles. So did you actually get sort of coaching and teaching then while you were there at Immobilien Scout? Or was that something that you, again, learned by doing it wrong first?
No, I got some teaching there. I got a little bit of teaching before that because I was working for a research institute in Germany, which is called Fraunhofer, because I wanted to get a PhD. But then someone needed to bring in the money, and I was one of the person bringing the money. So I didn't get a PhD, but just brought some money. I was a little bit on training there, but yeah, I got a lot of training at Immobilien Scout because they were growing, and at that time, and then they decided we need to help people managers become being good people managers. So that's what we need to do. And so I got some training there. And there was also this first big eureka moment in a training, because we had a training and then bought some stuff, and then the trainer, she took me and said, Stefan, do you have 5 minutes in the coffee break? And said, yeah, sure. And she said, Stefan, but you know that people are motivated in different ways. So people can be motivated even if they are different than you are. Because I'm very competitive, and if someone doesn't want to win, I felt they are not motivated. You know, so it was like it's one of my not so good traits. I want to win everything, so it's very difficult sometimes to play against me. But she told me people are different, and it's obvious, but. But that was the first time someone said something like this, that people are still motivated, are still great, but they are different than you.
Yeah, so it's like an eye-opening moment for you then.
So that was the first training, the real great training. And the second step where I became much better was I had a great boss at eBay. She was the best boss I ever had. She was really, really great. And she helped me a lot becoming a better manager.
What were some of the big things you learned from her in terms of dealing with people then? Because I think it is often, you know, as tech leaders, we're often very good at leading with the tech and knowing what to do with the tech. And as you say, standing on the table and saying, we should do it this way. But when it comes to the people side of it, what was it that you learned from her in particular?
One thing that she helped me in particular is I'm someone who always talks to people on eye level, whoever you are. I don't care. Like I talk to an intern on eye level and I talk to a senior developer or to the CEO, to me, it's all just people. And I talk to everyone the same way and treat everyone basically the same way, which is not a good thing, I learned. But she said, Stefan, but you understand that even if you talk to the junior developer or to the intern on eye level, it's not from their perspective. It's not, you know, they are junior developer and you the CTO. It's just like, just because you assume, and it's kind of probably some kind of hybris on my part, but just because I assume I'm talking to you on equal terms, it's not that you perceive it the same way. Looking back from that point, I made some mistakes in the past where, for example, I talked to junior developers and they didn't say, Stefan, you're stupid. You know, or this is what you're saying is stupid, because they thought, well, I had no problems with them telling me I'm stupid, but they didn't want to do that because the gap was too big.
Yeah. So your words came with all the weight of the title that you held at the time.
And I assumed they would say this because it was fine to me. So after years later, I also got into the habit of asking people, does this make sense? And I also tell people, if I say something stupid, just tell me. So whenever a meeting ended or I said something, if I said something stupid, tell me. Or does this make sense? To the point when I left as a fractional CTO company, one employee said she will always remember me for the manager who said, if I'm stupid, tell me. So this really was a kind of a...
became a catchphrase for you.
Already kind of a catchphrase for me and in the company and on the team.
Wow. I guess that's kind of a fun thing to be remembered by.
Yeah.
And so when you were going through that process of learning then, are there any sort of big challenges that stand out in your memory as sort of big pivot points? I mean, you mentioned a couple already, but because when I was going through and learning, I became a CTO by becoming a founder. And so then I recruited the people into my team and I'd had some experience recruiting up until then. So that was okay. But for me, I kind of got to this point where I suddenly had like a team of 5 or 6 people and wasn't actually sort of sharing my time out very well. And I had this moment where I sort of ended up feeling like I'd been stretched to breaking point and then snap. And that for me stands out as one of those moments where I had to really shift what I was doing. Do you have any moments like that when it comes to leading people?
A little bit, yes. Not in that way, but I realized I had the thinking that if I bear the responsibility for what's happening, I should make the decisions. And so I was planning a lot and thinking a lot and making decisions on my own. And then sometimes looking back, I realized the decisions were okay, but they're probably not uniquely great. So someone else could have made them. And at that point, I shifted as much as possible all decisions to other people, to the people who are closer to the information, who are closer to the work. So, and when someone said, Stefan, what should I do? I said, what would you do? You know, so that was my standard reply to someone asking me what they should do. I was really pushing decisions to people instead of having the feeling that I needed to make all of them because I'm the manager and I'm the CTO or I'm the team lead or I'm the head of development or whatever. That was really that made everything much easier.
Yeah, I can imagine. So it sort of takes the pressure off you. But at the same time, it's also one of those common lessons. I mean, have you come across the book Turn the Ship Around?
Yeah.
So yeah, because it's basically the sort of the prime point in there. Does that relate strongly to what you're saying there?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And so for those people listening who haven't come across that book, the book is called Turn the Ship Around. It's by a submarine captain from the US called David L. Marquette. And he basically had this idea that as he came in to be in charge of a submarine that was one of the lowest performing in the fleet, he looked at the Navy doctrine where it was sort of top-down control, command and control, and said, this feels backwards compared to the way that management's done elsewhere. And so he basically every time asked the question, you know, what would you do? And it got to the point where he then ended up basically saying as little as possible and getting ready to say to him, I intend to do whatever it is. And he would either go, yep, okay, or have you thought about so-and-so?
Yeah, and that really transformed, I think, was one of the points. Other points that changed, that was kind of, I don't know if they were pivotal, but I remember a lot of incidents over the years, like sitting in a t-shirt 2 o'clock in the morning in a video conference with people from DevOps or senior developers trying to figure out why the server would not start or something, you know, it stopped working or some service stopped working. And we were thinking about how can we get it work again? I was once on holiday, and my wife woke up in the hotel and thought, oh, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Why is Stefan telephoning in the bathroom? And I was in the bathroom because someone called me and said, Stefan, we tried everything. Nothing is we thought about calling you. So there are a lot of very stressful incidents, essentially, that I remember most, besides some great moments, but somehow these incidents is the things I remember most.
Those really harsh moments always seem to stick out in the memory. They always seem to be at 2 o'clock in the morning for some reason, don't they?
It's, yeah.
Universal truth. Cool. So when it comes to...
Yeah, sometimes it's at 12 o'clock in the night, but then one was at 12 o'clock. We said, okay, well, let's wait. We need to do some server maintenance, 12 o'clock at midnight. And then you do all the maintenance and then you start the server and it doesn't come back. And then at 7 o'clock in the morning, I think the shop is opening up in this company because they had a model where there was new stuff at 7 o'clock or something. And then it's like 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock. Server is still not there. Time until 50,000 or 60,000 people will arrive at the shop is getting closer and closer. So that was not at 2 o'clock. That was at midnight. But yeah.
Yeah, those 3 of the night deadlines, never fun, especially when you've got a hard stop like that where people start coming online. Cool. When it comes to leading people in, because I mean, you've gone through with us here a bit of a playbook, which you called sort of people first. And by the sounds of that, was something that as a concept you sort of came around to over time rather than something that you had from the beginning. But should we just go through that in order? Because one of the first things we put in there was about hiring. So how did you come to the conclusion that, I mean, a lot of people say it, but how did you come to the realization that hiring is such a crucial step in the process?
Because of my experiences and the experiences of my clients, if you hire the wrong people, you can't get things done. It's not just not working. If they are the wrong people, whatever wrong people means, and it's not by, they are not wrong by themselves. It's just the team and the task and the job and the person that are not fitting. It's nothing wrong about the person. So whenever I say wrong person, it's never about the person. It's just in the situation. And if you have not the right people at hand, I think you can't accomplish anything. So it really starts with hiring the right people. And people or the managers I talk to often hire for the wrong criteria. Like they spend, I don't know, 80% on hard skills, 15% on soft skills, 5% on fit. And then they hired someone, someone lately asked me, I hired someone and he's not motivated. And then I asked, yeah, well, okay, how did you check motivation during the interview process? Oh, I didn't. Well, then surprise. So there are a lot of people, I think, ask the wrong question for various reasons. They ask the wrong questions and then they hire someone who they are not happy with. So hiring the right people is, I think, core to everything.
Yeah. So the right people with the right skills and the right motivations and the right perspectives as well. Because I think different people want different things out of a role that they join, don't they?
Yes. Which is something you should ask them. What do you want? Like, I always ask them, because I'm people first person, I always ask some stuff in hiring to make sure I can make that happen. It's not like, it's not like some psychology question that I ask. People say, oh, that's some, no, I ask these things, where you want to be or what do you want from the company or why, what would we need to make this a dream job for you or something like this, you know? And then they just to check if I could do that, if that's possible, that's a reason I ask them. So I understand what their desires are, where they want to get to. And that's already determined in hiring, I think, in the recruiting, in the interview.
Yeah. So once you've recruited somebody in, you brought somebody in, there's obviously that crucial onboarding period. But then once you've got somebody sort of, you know, inside the business, inside their role, comfortably got their feet under the table, metaphorically, how do you then go about making sure that you continue to have that fit and the motivation and the excitement?
I'm very high on alignment. So I spend a lot of time on aligning people, on my vision and on how I think things should be done. Well, I'm not a megalomaniac, but sounds like, but I'm not. But I spend a lot of time on aligning people and keep them aligned, because I think if everyone is aligned, they are more successful and happier and everyone is happier. And one way to do this, one crucial thing to do this, especially with remote now, is having one-on-ones, weekly one-on-ones with all your direct reports. I think that's crucial to aligning people. But managers make so many mistakes with one-on-ones that I sometimes ask myself or ask them, I'm not sure how anything works in your department, because like from my point, it's very subjective and I'm not right all the time, but from my perspective, they make so many mistakes with one-on-one that I think, why is this working?
And so what is the secret to a good one-to-one from your perspective then? Because I mean, I'm a big proponent of one-to-one as well. I got my way of doing it. How do you get people to run a good one-to-one if you look at them and go, well, you're not running a good one-to-one to begin with?
So first, again, it's not the only way for a good one-on-one. It's just one way that works for me and probably for others. I think the biggest mistake from my perspective on several mistakes, but one mistake is making it about a status and project updates. I don't think you should, I don't want to have any project or status updates. Like if you want to give me the information, send me an email. And if I need to look into it, I look into it. If I don't, I don't. And as long as my expectation is everything works as discussed, and you don't need to tell me that it works as discussed. And if it's not working, then you can come to me. But we do this in some setup outside of a one-on-one. I'm not following up on projects or status or something in one. So that's the first thing. Second, do one-on-ones. Like there was only probably one reason I move a one-on-one with someone is when my boss tells me he needs to see me or something, like, I need to see you, Stefan. And it collides with a one-on-one, and then I move the one-on-one. But otherwise, I don't move it ever.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think sickness is probably one of the only reasons I look at as a reason to move a one-to-one.
Yeah. So, but some people take it too easy. Like, but the idea is the one-on-one is a meeting for the employee and not for me. It's their meeting. It's not my meeting. It's theirs. And it's for their benefit mostly. So why should I move it? I find it disrespectful. So not talking about status, not moving it. And then you're already halfway there. And then talking about...
Because you said it should be weekly, right? In the cadence in terms of which you run it. Yeah.
I need it weekly because I need two things. I want to hear from the direct report about their thoughts about the strategy, thoughts about technology, thought about new business ideas, like everything they hear, what are their thoughts in that? How do they feel? What is their mood? What should we do? What do they think we should do? Does my strategy make sense? And all of that is something I wanted to hear with them. And also how they want to develop, where they want to go, how I can support them. So it's their meeting, essentially. I only use it for myself or for my purposes in aligning them. Like, I don't know, the CEO has an all hand. After the all hand, I will ask everyone in their one-on-ones, what have you heard? What do you think of this? What did you think the CEO wants? You know, and then the person says something that's not what the CEO meant. And I talk to the CEO more often. So I say, you know, I think that's not what he meant. He thinks, you know. So I align people on events and on everything in one-on-one. So that's what I get out of it, aligning people.
Yeah, so very big on the alignment then.
And then for that, I need a weekly one.
The herding cat challenge and try and keep everybody going in the same direction.
Yeah, I think it's a constant, especially with remote. With an office, I ask people about their ideas and their opinion in an elevator or at the coffee machine or at lunch or, you know, so I ask people what they think about stuff all the time. But in a remote setup, it's more difficult. And so I think the one-on-one is even more important.
Yeah, I like weekly because, I mean, the best description I ever heard of it was it's a bit like if you want to tear down the Golden Gate Bridge, right, just running a bulldozer through it once really strongly is not going to do it. But if you just push it gently on the right cadence, then you get a massive amount of power into it. And that's why I've come up with the conclusion of weekly. It seems to have the most impact just regularly. And then it can be shorter. It can be less energy each time. But it just needs to be regular. Just showing up, I think, is a big part of doing a good one-to-one.
Yes, I agree.
Do you run one-to-ones any different for a team lead than you do for an individual contributor?
No. What I learned is that I need to treat people on their level. You know, so I treat people, a junior, differently than a developer, than an intern, than a senior, than a lead, than a head of development. So I need to, I think one mistake I made in the past is treat people like I wanted to be treated. So not micromanage on some stuff. And it took some time to learn that you need to treat people the way they need to be treated instead of how you want to be treated.
Yeah. Meet them on their level, not on your level.
Yeah. I think that was also eBay training. I think it's on situation leadership and stuff. So this is where this came from. So, but overall, no, but for my direct reports, like I do both. I do skip level meetings and I think everyone should do skip level meetings, talking to developers, even if you're the CTO and even if they do not report to you. In the skip level meetings, I might focus more on even more on mood and how do they feel and what do they think instead of what I do in a regular one-on-one.
Right. Okay. So more about the tone and feeling of how everybody's working rather than the specific issues or challenges, because that should in theory be taken up by the direct leader.
Yeah. But then again, I also used 10 minutes to tell them the story. What's the story? Why are we here? What's the story of the department? Where are we going? What's my vision? So yeah, I use skip level meeting also for that.
Again, reinforcing the alignment.
Yes.
Yeah. So and in terms of the frequency of running skip level or indirect report one-to-ones, do you do that the same? Do you do that weekly even for your indirect reports, or do you run a different schedule for them?
As is possible, which is mostly usually once per half year, having a skip level meeting with everyone half a year. If it's larger, then every year. So it depends on the size and on how much time you have and the size of the department.
Right. So it's basically it's scaled based on the number of total reports in your tree than anything else. Okay. So then in terms of for you, how much time do you dedicate to it, regardless of the number of employees?
When I was, so I didn't become a CEO at one of the eBay companies or a COO, where it usually starts, but I was at this high potential training several times in the US in San Jose, and we talked to senior leaders, and one said they spend 50% of their time on people.
50% of their time.
They do two things. Sorry for my English. They do two things. First, they actively plan how much time they want to spend on things. Like, I want to spend 20% of strategy. So they're not reactive to their time spending, but they are proactive to their time spending. And second, he said he's spending 50% of his time on people. And so this is what I also try to do, or have tried in the past.
That's a good metric, but quite a strong rule of thumb then in terms of the amount of time spent on people. But I guess when it comes down to alignment, then you're doing probably one of the most fundamentally important things of a leader at that point, which is keeping everybody going in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fluffy definition and an unsharp edge. What's people when I spend time? So if I do this, is it about the people or not? So it's not like, well, one-on-one is clear cut, but there are some other activities that are not that clear cut concerning people. But overall, spend more time on people. I think that's what you should do. Because if you lift the team, I think that's the biggest lever, lifting the team or helping them. It's not about you lifting them. It's about helping them.
Helping them. Yeah. I mean, so one of the things you said about that was sort of understanding the motivation, where they want to go and why. And then how do you tend to go about actually giving that support or providing that support? You mentioned already, can we figure out how we can help them get to where they want to go? But are there any other things that you have in your toolbox that are particularly noteworthy for supporting employees with getting to where they want to go?
My biggest contribution, I think, is helping them find out where they want to go. For a lot of them, like I had some direct reports, they show up and say, Stefan, I'm here, I want to be there, help me. You know, that's how it, and some, but that's not the norm.
No, that's the minority, isn't it, really?
Yes, that's a minority. I think the majority of people don't know where they want to be. And often they are, what I see as a pattern, no, I'm happy where I am. I'm happy where I am. I'm happy where I am. I'm unhappy. You know, that's, so we don't need to talk about where I want to go. I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm unhappy. I'm leaving. So sometimes I force people to talk about this because I know that, yes, you might think you're happy now, but this is not something that, this might not last for the next 2 years or 3 years. And I'm for long-term relationships and long-term relationships. So I want to work with the person for a longer time. And so we discuss what the person likes, what they did like as a child, what they are not comfortable with, why they want to do this, why they want to go somewhere, a lot of these things. And there's probably several months of one-on-ones until until we find out where the person wants to be in the future.
Yeah, it's funny. I often do a sort of a mission statement with people that I'm coaching, where I sort of help them tease out those kinds of questions. But I find that you sort of have to be working with somebody for at least 3, sometimes 6 months before they're ready to actually open up and talk about some of those things. Because number one, they don't really know themselves, as you just said. But secondly, it's really hard to have the trust to articulate some of the underlying drivers unless you sort of build up that rapport and relationship with them first before them to open up and go, actually, what I'd really like to do is this.
And especially what you mentioned, trust is such an underrated concept, I think, in business. It's so my boss needs to trust me, my direct reports need to trust, I need to trust them. So it's always not a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. Trust, and it makes things so much easier. So I find companies are not focusing enough on trust.
No, I'd agree with that completely. Because having worked with military and with special forces people in particular, there's this very different approach they have. You know, we've got a load of different metrics and measures for how people are performing and performance, and that can be measured in a number of different ways. But often it comes down to revenue of some sort or other. But we have very, very few metrics on trust. Whereas the special forces, it's one of the two primary things they look at, actually, is how trustworthy somebody is. And yet business, you know, in general, business takes so little attention to it. And I find it one of those very interesting things. Do you have any kind of metrics or measures or values that you look at in terms of trust and whether somebody's trustworthy? Or is that something that's kind of instinctive to you at this stage?
I think that to me it's instinctive. I have been part of some companies where it's management surveys and how good is your boss and do you trust him and stuff like that. But for me, it's mostly I trust someone or I don't trust someone, and I'm just very careful. Trust and also loyalty and stuff is a very, it's like a soap bubble. It takes time to build up, and then the wrong touch and makes bloop and it's gone. So you need to be very careful. It takes a lot of effort to build, and it's very easy to lose. And that's how I look at that. So I'm always very careful around not destroying trust.
That's an interesting concept, because it is kind of an asymmetric currency, isn't it? You earn it very, very slowly, but when you spend it, you tend to spend it in big chunks.
And you never need to have earned it. It's same with loyalty. It's like, I'm not firing you at the first wimp. I think that I get you through things, and that builds loyalty. And then you need to build these things when you come into a crisis. Like there might be an incident, or the company's in a crisis, and then suddenly companies want to draw on trust and loyalty and all of this, but they didn't spend effort in the years to build it. And then they want to draw on that. That's not working. So, and then they fail, you know? So it sounds hollow if you say, trust me, but you didn't spend time on building the trust.
Absolutely. And then that turns into one of those leadership pet hates of yours, which is surprise, because you've talked about as a leader, trying really hard not to surprise people, employees and engineers in particular. And that's one way where you sort of don't build up the trust before you try and use it. But equally, there's a couple of other examples you had as well. So what are the other sort of ways in which you look at avoiding surprising people?
I just had a coaching session, CTO, they want to change something. CTO is thinking about migrating from one programming language to another one, and wants to present that to the team. And I said, don't surprise them that this will not work well. Like, I don't think this would work well. What I would do is I talk to them in a one-on-one and say, I think we have a lot of problem with this programming language. I have been thinking about moving to something different, to a different setup. And then let's see what the person is saying and how they react. And then I tell them again in a one-on-one, and then I might come up with a plan and say, this is project 2025. We're going to do this and this and this. I might not make the decision even that, like discussed before. I don't think I might be the best person to make the decision. But even if I make the decision, I don't want to surprise people in this way, because then there is some already resistance building up, and they think fight or flight. They are surprised, and they're not open to my arguments or to my story. So I think don't surprise people with all of these decisions and all of this. Why should I talk about that before? It's not like, let's talk about that before. That also builds trust.
Yeah. But then you're sort of separating out how you introduce something in sort of whether it's one-to-one, whether it's in a group session, and making sure that you've got a distinguished element between the problem, the proposal, and then the solution. Sort of almost as three separate steps with sometimes three different audiences. Did I understand that right?
Might be. And in general, I think I'm not keen on blindly doing something. If I, also with my clients, if they do something that works and I think, I wouldn't do that way, but it works, then keep doing it. If it, like, I look at things more, does it work or doesn't it work? And I always put a lot of effort into making sure something works, because that's also a concept that I think people are not talking enough about is we have, especially in this, in my context, which is startups, fast growing startups. So this is how my clients, and this is where I spent most of my years. This is where the color of my hair comes from.
No, about reducing surprises and taking away the risk, almost take away the risk, really.
And making something work. And the idea is to make something work is I overcommit to the solution. Like I think, what are the things that that we can do to make it work? This and this and this and this and this. And then I do five things. And if these are five different meetings with five different groups, and I think that's the best solution to the problem, or this will make the solution work. It's not the solution, but that will make the solution work. Because from my experience, it's the difficult thing is to make something work instead of coming up with the solution. Coming up with the solution is easy, but making it, adopting it, changing people, transform, that's the hard part. So if I need five meetings with five different groups, and I think that's best to solving this problem, I will do that. I will overcommit to a problem to solve it and make it, or overcommit to a solution to make the solution work and get the problem away. Because in this startup setup that I talked about, people are so overworked a lot of the times that they only spend the minimal amount of work to, they think, what's the minimal amount of things that I could do to make the problem, to fix the problem? You know, and I think always, what's the maximum thing I could do to fix the problem? Because then it stays away. It's solved and it never comes back. But if you always do the minimal thing to solve a problem, then it will be back in 2 months. So I might have, coming back to the question, I might have three meetings with three different groups. If this is, I don't try to be efficient and invite everyone into one meeting and then, oh, then we only have 1 hour and that's efficient. I don't want to be, for me, it's effectiveness first. Efficiency second in this environment where I work. Sorry, very long story, but that's the thinking behind this.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, it's in terms of that, it really is about focusing on the one thing and doing that completely rather than doing it just a bit and skipping along to the next thing, which is in the startup world is actually the temptation. So I think your approach there pushes towards the way of excellence, which is the non-intuitive way, I think, for most people coming into it from sort of first principles.
Most people just want to invest the minimal amount of time to fix something. And then it comes back and then they have a hydra of too many heads and then they drown. And then they drop, and then they ask, come probably to you or to me. Because people come to a CTO coach usually not when everything is fine and dandy.
Yeah, normally when they need to dig themselves out of a hole somewhere. Yeah. Common refrain. Cool. So if we try and sort of boil down your playbook then. So you said go run through it in roughly the order of dealing with people. So you win and lose with hiring, I think was pretty much your first point there. Your second point, which is a very strong one, is a one-to-one every week with every direct report and be consistent. Don't cancel or push around that meeting. We also mentioned therefore that skip level one-to-ones. And I remember from your book, you got a different name for that. You call that CTO Coffee, is that right?
Yes, I call it CTO Coffee, yeah.
Where did that name come from? There must be a story behind that.
No, it probably is, but I forgot. but the reason, there is a reason. There's a reason for this because it's non-threatening. It's non-threatening to the person I'm skipping because the person I'm skipping may think, oh, why is my boss talking to my reports? So it's they feel threatened and the junior developer who I get an invitation from the CTO feels threatened. So, but they don't never, no one gets, feels threatened by CTO coffee. So that's having a coffee with the CTO. That's not threatening.
Go on, low expectations and low fear. That's a good way to think about it. Cool. And then you spoke about two things to do with almost the way you run one-to-ones, but also that way you manage people indirectly. So one of them was figure out the motivation and figure out how you can keep each person motivated. You mentioned about the direction that people want to go in, what their ambition is, and then how you can support them in getting there, if you can, hopefully you can, which I think was a key one. I think closely related to that as well, which you didn't touch on too much, is about clear guidance on the role. I mean, I'm a big one on creating job descriptions for every role.
Yes. I think that's very, very important. Coming back to hiring, a lot of people don't have job descriptions but want to hire for a job. I don't know how I would hire for a job if I don't have a clear job description. And my job description, the way I do it is I have four groupings, which is first is why. So why is the person there? Why are you there? Second is responsibilities. Third is ownerships. And fourth is success factors. So how your success will be measured or...
The measurement of it, right. So, and how do you divide up the ownership and responsibilities then?
It's a little bit the same thing, but it's like sometimes it's easier... Like if I say last one is turning off the lights. That's easy as a responsibility, but I can't say you're owning the light switch. You know, that sometimes.
Right. Okay.
It's just not working.
So sometimes it's more about how you present it than what it's really actually about.
And ownership is a little bit more and more complete and more. Whereas responsibility is more what I expect you to do or the organization expects you to do, whereas ownership is where you decide. So that's more.
That's a good distinction. I like that. Cool. And I think the other thing you mentioned about there, which was sort of we're up to number 7 on the list, was about treating people as, well, individuals, as people, rather than as just a collective. And you described it as pets versus cattle. Now, that's a phrase that I understand normally is the other way around, cattle versus pets, when we're talking about servers and infrastructure. But so you've inverted almost the same concept.
Yes, it's from that. And that's the distinction from people first versus process first. A lot of companies want to be process first. They want to scale, and they think the way to scale is by process first, people second. And I think success is with people first, process second. Not that process isn't important, but people first, I think, is more important. And that's a distinction between pets and kettles mean, or kettle and pet mean. Pets means usually you have 3 servers and every server has a name, so you treat them as pets. You have 1,000 servers and every server has a number, so you treat them as kettle. And that's a distinction between old setups or small setups and cloud setups. But I feel like that's the same often happens with HR departments by scaling. They start by treating people as pets, not as pets, but, you know, as something with an identity and a name. And then at some point want to get professional, often get outside HR help or hire a new head of HR. And then they want to professionalize everything. And that's usually the switch when it comes from people first to process first. And that's what I mean with pets and cattle.
Right. I think that's a really good distinction. So keep it people first. I've actually often seen advice from successful exited West Coast US CEOs, which often says the same thing, that their secret was down to making sure that people owned things, were treated as individuals and not as some sort of, as a number, basically.
I mean, when I worked at eBay, I think there was 35,000 employees. And I understand that you want to have some common denominator, how to manage HR, how do people manage 35,000 people, but still a lot of companies I work with have not 35,000 people, but still want to treat everyone as cattle.
And I think that's one of those dangers of startups, isn't it? It's the same, I've put it in the same bracket as when people go, well, Netflix uses thousands of microservices, so we should too. But, you know, even though they're not trying to stream, you know, thousands of simultaneous streams to hundreds of thousands of users.
Then you have 10 microservices per developer or something. You know, that's what they end up.
Yeah, it's got innumerable numbers of things to look after. Cool. And the last one on your list, which was the one that hopefully is the least surprise of being on the list, but that is literally not to surprise people, you know, keeping the shock away from the game.
I don't want to be surprised, and I feel a lot of people don't want to be surprised, and except perhaps for birthday, but otherwise surprises are not. Like the worst surprise I get is when someone comes to me, employee comes to me and says, Stefan, do we have 5 minutes time? I need to talk to you. Then, okay, I know what's going to happen.
You brace yourself for incoming surprises, yeah.
Yeah, that's I'm sure what's coming then. People, but person wants to leave.
Talking about what's coming next, I mean, so you've written the book, Amazing CTO, which is available. But you're working on something new now, aren't you?
But hasn't as much reviews as your book on Amazon. that's whenever I search my book for vanity, Yoast pops up, and so that's just. But no. It's just like it always pops up. Your book always. But yeah, let's talk about bad at sales and marketing.
No worries. I mean, you're working on something new at the moment for CTOs, right? So I mean, you're wearing the T-shirt of it.
Yeah, I'm working on something new. I have a T-shirt. I'm working on a. And kind of a notification. It's more of a notification service for dream jobs for CTO. So you tell the service what your dream job would be, platform, people, values, culture, salary, all of that things. And then if we find something, we connect you. It's not a job board. If you need something now, that's not Ink Me. It's called Ink Me. And it's called Ink Me because on Hacker News 10 years ago or something on Hacker News, there was a long list of five character.com domains, and then I got some of them, so and one of them is Ink Me, so that's the reason behind the name. There's no I need to find a better story probably, but that's the story of the name.
It's a story so far, yeah.
Available domain, five character available domain. Yeah, so it's not a job board, so it's not for searching for a CTO job, but it's more for long term. So you list there and then in 6 months, something might pop up or might not, but we try to find something that makes you happy.
Wow. Okay. So you essentially subscribed to be notified when your like ideal job pops up out of there.
Because a lot of my clients don't have, it's not their dream job. It's a good job, but it's not their dream job. So that's where it comes from.
Excellent. And if you were to, so I always ask this of all the people who come on the show, but if you were to give what, because I'm sure you talk to lots of people who are very early in their career all the time as a CTO, but if you were to give one key core piece of advice to somebody who's just come into the CTO role for the first time, importance above all others, what would it be?
Delegate.
Delegate.
So you need to delegate. You need to, it's more difficult than that. You need to have people to delegate to. You need to be good at delegation. But what breaks a lot of my clients is that they have a lot of stuff on their table. Then the company grows and everything grows and it's even more and more and more and more. And if they haven't started delegating early on, growing people by delegation, we'll get back to growing people. I can grow people by delegating stuff to them and let them fail. And then they get better. If you haven't done that early on, then at the time when you need it, just like trust, it's not there.
So delegate early and delegate often then. What a wonderful piece of advice. Stefan, it's been great having you on the show today. How can people find you if they want to reach out to you online?
They can find me on LinkedIn. So it's Stefan Schmidt on LinkedIn or Amazing CTO on LinkedIn or the domain amazingcto.com or www.amazingcto.com.
Excellent. We'll make sure we put those links in the notes of the show. Stefan, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you today.
It was great talking to you, Adam. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.